We've gone through Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are integrally related. So I think we've covered Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 about as much as we're going to do for now. So I think we're going to go on to Daniel chapter 8. And you say, whoa, what about Daniel 3 and 4 and 5? We might backfill those a little bit later. But remember last night, for those that were able to make it, we did cover all of those in an overview. And we kind of discussed those. So I think we're going to move on to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8 is fascinating in its own area. And let's see. There's 8. There's 8. Yeah, I got two of them on 8. There we go. This is all about the ram and the goat. Now, somebody tell me, just from your own knowledge, who does the ram in this vision of Daniel chapter 8 represent? And who does the goat represent? Now, I'm going to tell you, the ram has two horns, and the goat has one horn. So tell me what those horns represent, as well as what the animals represent. Shro, what do you got?
Medo-Persia, so the horns would be the Medes and the Persians.
Okay. And it says the higher one came up ladder, and we talked about that, Bill, so that would be Persia as opposed to the Medes that were stronger early on. Okay.
And the goat is Greece, especially, I think, Alexander the Great, right?
That big horn represents the first king of that empire, Alexander. He's not the first king of Greece, but he's the first king of the empire. He's with the one that made the empire. Boy, does that picture ever really tell you about a great horn? I mean, that really...
I've never seen a great like that, you know, but that's the way the vision suggests. So he runs headlong against him, and he is triumphant. Just the image tells you that that's going to happen. So that's Medo-Persia and that's Greece. Now, that's probably nobody is going to disagree with that, but can we prove that? Can we prove that that's Medo-Persia? Can we prove that that's Greece? Sure, all confidently nods your head yes, because we already have. And what tells us that?
Verse
20. Verse 20, 21. It tells you point blank.
The ram is Medo-Persia and the goat is Greece. And the big horn is the first king of Greece. And the two horns here are the two parts of the empire. So all of this is very straightforward. It's really not a problem. It's kind of nice to have this chapter start with such an explicit definition. Now, there's an empire before these two, a part of the four empires, that's not here in this chapter. Why not? What's the empire that's missing before these? Babylon. So we already talked about in that chapter 2, thou art the head of gold. And now in chapter 7, we refer to the lion was that. So we're going on beyond that for some more details about the succeeding empires. Now, this whole chapter, chapter 8, is given to us in what year?
Third year
of? Belshazzar. Belshazzar is what king of Babylon? The first, the middle, or the last? The last. He's going to die when Babylon is overthrown. Now, you gave us a lot of information yesterday. He's actually the son of Nabonidus, who was the last emperor. A lot of detail, and it's very good. I'm glad you know all that. But as far as we're concerned, he's the one that's going to die when the kingdom is overthrown. So we're at the end of the kingdom of Babylon. Now we're looking forward to what's coming next. We're not in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar anymore. That's long history before. Daniel is still alive, however. So, a vision appeared to me, even unto Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. Now, when was the first vision that appeared to Daniel? Chapter 7, when was that? First year of Belshazzar. Okay. Now, we can actually put dates on that if you want, because it turns out we know when Belshazzar began. He was appointed by his father in the third year of his father, and so the first date would be 553, and the next one would be 551 B.C., I'm not going to make a point of those, but I mean, you can actually put dates on it if you wish. And there's no reason, by the way, you know that sometimes they have different dates than some brethren do. No reason for these dates to be disputed. These are 553, 551. Nobody really should dispute those. Now he sees a vision by the river Ulai. Does anybody know where the river Ulai is? I don't think it's the same. I think it's a distinct river. I'm ready to say, but I'm not positive of this. If you check Wikipedia, you'd find out. I'm ready to say it's a river that's somewhere in the region of Persia. Now, as a matter of fact, I can demonstrate that. Verse 2. Let's read verse 2. Gloria, can you read that? Daniel 8:2.
I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai.
There you go. So Ulai is in the province of Elam. If you throw a map up there somewhere, I'll maybe point out something on that. So the very fact that he's in vision, situated in Shushan is the palace of not the Babylonians. That's going to be the capital of the new empire later on in a few years. And now Daniel was a diplomat. You know, he was in the administration. He probably had tours of duty that he had to spend in visiting other capitals and so forth. So it's probably why he knew where his vision was in his mind. He was in that place. And he recognized it. So he's now at a place that's going to be the center of the Persian Empire. Okay, maybe you don't find it. It's okay. Just any map. You know, you had a map before. Just throw that up there or anything you want. or even Shushan. I was just going to show you visually where it was, but it's in the Medo-Persian Empire. The location is appropriate to the vision, which is all about the Medes and Persians that are going to be overcome by the Grecian Empire. That should be good enough. Let's see. Susiana, I think that's Shushan. That's down here.
Look right above it.
right above it
in black.
Susa. Okay, thank you. There we go. Susa or Shusha or Shushan, something like that. So that's the location where Daniel was. Daniel was from Babylon, but he recognized that he was envisioned there at this time by the river Ulai. Now, I suspect all these rivers' names have some meaning. I just don't know what it is. But it's mentioned. Now, in verse 3, let's read this part of the vision, Gloria.
Verse 3, then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last.
Okay, now we've read part of this, you know, before, so I'm going to skip over parts of this. but in verse 6, he came to the ram, and he ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him. He smote the ram, brake his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him. He cast him to the ground, stamped upon him. There was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Now, verse 8. Now we're in the Grecian Empire. So now I'm going to go back to my diagrams, if I could. Go back to the Grecian Empire. And now to this goat with, going to have four horns. Go ahead and read the verse 8.
Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven.
Okay, now there you've got the four horns on this Grecian goat, after the first horn is broken off, and those four horns represent the divisions of the Grecian Empire. And I guess I should... Well, let's see. Oh, we got a map. We got a map here. Let's see.
We can turn that board around.
Let's see. Let me go. There we go. There's something. Turn that board around. So, okay, I see. So I could write. But we'll see.
Whatever.
Now, on this map, we've got here Egypt. That was one part of the Grecian Empire. And then we've got this area up here. Up here, which would be Macedonia. And that's another part of the Grecian Empire. And that took a little bit of this area as well. And then we got the bulk of this whole area of Turkey. That was a third empire. I think that was under Lysimachus. And then we got this whole huge expanse of the empire over here. That was taken by a man named Seleucus. And those are the four empires. And let's see, let's just put these on the board here. And I think I'm going to erase part of this. I know I could flip it, but I might as well just erase it. I'm going to keep this. I like that so much. That'd be a reminder of the prophetic days of Daniel, you know, and that how we solidified that down. So,
That's not doing too well. I'll be all right. It is okay. So tell me, of these four generals in Egypt, who ruled Egypt? Of those four, I won't say all generals. I often say that, but it's not explicitly correct. Some of them were advisors. Say that again?
Ptolemy.
Okay. I like the way you pronounce that.
I'm not sure how to pronounce
it. But the Ptolemy. Okay.
The T is silent, I think. It's Ptolemy, I think.
Ptolemy? Okay. Egypt. And then who ruled that whole big eastern part of the empire? That's the biggest part. Seleucus. Now we're going to read a lot about the Ptolemy and the Seleucid Empire when we get into chapter 11. That'll be tomorrow. Won't be today. And then who ruled? Let's see. What did I say? Macedonia. Say again? Antiochus? Oh, okay. But of the four, I think there's a different name.
Is either Cassander or Lysimachus?
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm going to go with Cassander. Oh, I spelled it wrong. This is in volume 3. You'll see these listed. My memory is not always real sharp on this part either, but I think Cassander was Macedonia, and Lysimachus was Thrace. Now, whenever I see the word Thrace, I always think, where's Thrace? Where's that? Can anybody tell me what Thrace is?
It's up near Romania.
Near Romania?
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
I remember from the Romanian history there was a part that we call Thracia.
Yes. Okay, so that would be it.
And then Romania was built up on that place.
So okay.
To me,
so they were off the map up here, Romania, right? Okay. But the Thrace we're talking about here is down here in Turkey. Now, maybe there's another Thracia that maybe the power went up north farther. I don't know.
I thought it was up a little north of Greece.
Oh.
Yeah, it is. Just,
yeah.
Thrace?
Yep.
What the previous map showed.
Really?
Yep. Yeah,
okay.
You might want to check that out.
Okay, well, then I'm mixed up somewhere. But this was the area of the Fourth Kingdom. This part here in Turkey. And then Syria took all the rest of it. So I don't know, maybe I'm wrong calling it Thrace. But
I think Thrace, the way it worked is Macedonia was Macedonia, south to Greece, and then, if I remember right, I think that it was Asia Minor, but it extended up the coast. I mean, it was
Asia Minor is here.
Yeah, it crossed over Asia Minor into Europe along the coast of the Black Sea.
Some
and
of the stuff up here.
I think it was a larger area than just
this. Then
yeah.
Maybe that's how to reconcile those two opinions. Maybe it's extended up farther northward, and you got next to Romania.
Yes, and I also remember the name of Lysimachus. We learned in history about him.
Oh, really? Okay,
yes.
Good. So we're right connecting him to Thrace.
We had even legends, short legends, and he was, I can't remember exactly what was about him, but something specific, what he did when he came to conquer.
Okay, good. I'm glad for that little personal history. That's good. Okay, I think we're on the right track then. Now, as it turned out, these two people started to fade out as time went by. But they were independent kingdoms, and I'm glad for that note of special interest in the history of Lysimachus that shows how independently strong he was at some point in time. So these are the two that we're going to read around chapter 11, the king of the south and the king of the north. Kind of these other kingdoms were subsumed in their kingdoms. But originally they were all four independent, separate kingdoms. And so they ranked as four separate horns from the Grecian goat. And again, we marked on this last night how peculiar this was. Every transition of king of Babylon from Nebuchadnezzar to Amel-Marduk to Nergal-Sheshar to one guy in between, Labashi-Marduk, and then Nabonidus, every one of those transition went, the whole kingdom went with him.
every one of the dozen or so kings of the Persian Empire, it was a whole kingdom transferred with him. But suddenly, the very first king of Greece, as soon as he dies, the kingdom is split into four parts. This is really radical. This is unique. Didn't happen in the Roman Empire this way. It all went unified, you know. But right here, that's a stunning, unique thing. And the fact that Daniel could predict that 150 years ahead of time, okay, this is divine inspiration. And if you admit Daniel is divinely inspired, who's going to doubt that Isaiah was, or Jeremiah, or Zechariah? That's why Daniel is the battleground for inspiration. Critics say it has to be a fraud, but more and more they're losing the battle on this point. We talked about that last night some more. But so this is very stunning prophecy. But now, the next verse talks about this little horn, and that's where differences of opinion begin to come in the interpretation of Daniel chapter 8. Up to this point, really everybody's straightforward. Now let's look at verse 9. Who was reading? Was that Gloria?
Yeah.
And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land.
What is the glorious land?
Israel.
Israel. That's the Israel land. Yeah. And so it's going to wax exceeding toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Okay. that's okay. I don't really... If you find something really good, well, that's okay. Well, let's go back here. There we go. Lysimachus, and he goes all the way up there. See, he's primarily here, all the way up to the corner there. Okay, and you're getting towards Romania. You're on the Black Sea. Romania's on the Black Sea. Yeah, okay. So, and then Cassander over here, Macedonia and Greece, and then Seleucus, and then Ptolemy. Yeah, that's a good map to show those distinct divisions. That's good. Okay. So now, this says that out of one of those four lands comes forth a little horn. Now, it doesn't tell us which kingdom it is. In fact, it doesn't even identify the four kingdoms for us. This is the four kingdoms. Out of one of those comes forth a little horn, and it waxes toward the south, and toward the west, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land, which would be Israel. So if you're going to go south, and you're going to go east, and you're going to go toward the pleasant land, maybe you're over here somewhere. You know, what is this little horn? Who would venture a guess as to what this little horn is that comes out of one of the other four horns?
Rome.
Now, the word papacy, it's going to come into the picture here. It's going to. But let's just say Rome for right now, geographically. Rome. Now, here's the problem. How did Rome come out of one of those four horns? Now, I think the answer to Rome is correct. I think there's three different answers that can be correct, but I think Rome is the prominent one. That's the one we usually follow. That's the one in volume 3. It's the one most people follow. So explain to me, how can Rome come out of one of these four horns? Randy?
Quick possibly is because early Roman history often is described as a copy of many of the institutions of Greece.
Okay, you're talking about a cultural system. Now, as a matter of fact, one of the historical books, not related to prophecy, that I happened to access when thinking about this, talked about the Hellenic city of Rome. Hellenic, what they mean is the Grecianized city of Rome. So that's talking about the fact that Grecian culture had gone in this direction. Now, maybe Alexander didn't take his armies there and invade them, but Greek culture certainly won them over. And this is like Western culture today, is, you know, many places they didn't conquer, but it's just the permeation of Western culture. I actually think that's the right answer. I wish I could be positive of it, but I think that that is the right answer. I think it means that from the Grecian influence of Hellenic Rome, that's where Rome developed out of, that Grecian. Now, we all know, I knew since I was a kid, and I loved to read the Roman mythologies and the Greek mythologies. I don't know, if I thought of them as pagan, I wouldn't have liked it, but I didn't think, I was just a kid. I loved reading them. Then I learned early on, all these Roman gods are just the Greek gods by a different name. It's all the same culture. Yeah, somebody else had their hand up? Yeah, Jeff?
Do you have any other suggestions of what that could be? I know in one of your talks that I had listened to, you said there were
four
ideas. I think
I can remember
last night you remembered three, but you only gave two in the talk.
I only gave two in the talk. Okay, well, remind me when I get to these which one I'm missing. Like, I'm not sure. But if you ask Jim Parkinson this question, I think this is what he would say. Did you have a comment on this?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Jim Parkinson said that really from the city of Tyre is where the people came that settled Italy. And sometimes we call the Italians Etruscans. And if Jim Parkinson was here, he would explain it that Etruscan means the way of Tyre. Etruscan, T-R, that comes from the Tyre, and it means they came from Tyre. So that's maybe right. And let me ask you, who are the two famed person, maybe fabled persons, that started the city of Rome? They both start with an R. Romulus and Remus. Now, what were they suckled by? How did they grow?
A wolf
suckled by... Does that sound credible, really? That's really, you know... But Jim Parkinson would say, well, a wolf was the symbol of Tyre. Well, I don't know how he knows that. I'm just giving you what I've heard. I mean, he's very bright. He's very studied. I presume there's some foundation. Otherwise, I wouldn't refer to him. You know, I respect him. But if that's true, you see, that would lend some credibility to what he's saying. Suckled by a wolf? The point is that they were nourished from Tyre. That's where the colony came from. Maybe that's the reason for that legend. So maybe the point. So he says that the reason this came out of one of the four is because they came from Tyre, which had been taken over by, well, intermittently, either the Ptolemy or the Greek Empire. They went back and forth. And so that's how this horn came out from them. One of the problems of that, of course, is that it's coming out from them before the four horns ever existed. But that's okay. I mean, I don't know, the prophecy is a little... Okay. Jeff, you were going to say...
Yeah, this doesn't have any basis in historical fact, but I just find it interesting that the Romans even thought of it this way, is when Virgil wrote the Aeneid, I mean, they wanted to have their own story about where their civilization came from. So Aeneas was supposedly from Troy. And when the Trojans lost to the Greeks, they came to Rome and founded the city of Rome, and that's became the Roman mythology, the Aeneid, of where their culture came from. They were actually Trojans, is what they thought, or
okay.
Didn't really think, but that was the mythology. So
okay, interesting. Okay, I'll have to talk to Jim about that and see what he says.
Yeah, yeah.
He might say, well, yeah, but the Tyrians were the colonies for Troy. You know, I don't know. I know the Tyrians are thought to be the colony for Carthage. Where's Carthage? Up here or down here? I forget just where. It's up here, I think. Anyway.
In between.
And there's somewhere else? Okay.
Of course, it's at the boot.
Yeah.
Down from here? Carthage? It's Carthage. It's in North Africa.
Yeah.
So it's across from the boot. Is that what you're saying?
No, I take it back. You were right. It is in Tunis. But it's
up here. Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Tunis.
Yeah.
So those are two different... The basic question is, how do you explain that Rome came out of one of the four horns? Now, here's a third possibility, Jeff. When Rome began to expand, it took over this area, came through this area, and then came to Israel. Well, it took over this area, too. And so, when it's coming towards Israel, it's coming out of the old Grecian Empire. Okay, that's a third possibility I've heard. And did you say there are four possibilities I referred to? Okay, there's another one then. I can't remember it right now.
Okay.
But this is why some people dispute that this is even Rome at all. And there may be an alternate level of understanding the prophecy that really refers to another power. It could, in fact, be the Islamic power. But most of the brethren today are taking it as Rome. I'm going to take it from that standpoint as we begin this, but then I might look at some other possibilities later. But I do think Rome is correct. So now in verse 10, well, let's say it was from Rome. We just read verse 9, and it says, one of them came forth a little horn, exceeding great toward the south. Well, they did. They went over and took over Ptolemy. Who was the famous queen of Egypt at the time the Romans took over? Cleopatra. That's Antony and Cleopatra, and then Julius Caesar got involved. That's that whole movie and episode and all that. So that was a very famous episode, the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, I think. That's when finally the Romans finally just took it over. And so they went to the south country. They went to the east. They went to take all of these lands here. And they went toward the pleasant land, Rome. I mean, Palestine, Israel. So that would fit the description. That kind of matches. Now let's look at verse 10. Gloria?
And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them.
Now, if this is Rome, yes,
the brethren have to, some of the brethren have to get off the internet because we're suffering on bandwidth to broadcast. So I don't know who's all on. Anyway, I'm just making that announcement.
You mean it's so crowded?
Well, our house, it's all these brethren here. I don't know who's all on the internet.
Oh, you're talking about some of the brethren in this room should click off. Okay, okay. If you're listening live, don't listen on record either. Okay, that's what he said. I get the point. So the other brethren can really hear. Okay. So in the room, please disconnect if you're on it, unless you have an extraordinary reason, I guess. So now in verse 10, if this is Rome, in what sense did Rome wax great to the host of heaven and cast some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped on them? When did Rome do that? And who are these stars that you cast down to the earth and stamped on them? Sounds like a persecution. Marge?
Microphone. Yeah, I believe the Romans, as the Papal Rome in particular, persecuted the Christians and cast down some of the bishops, especially in when they had the Council of Nicaea. They got the bishops to come together, and then Athanasius succeeded in getting the idea of the Trinity across to them and things like that. And as the Pope took over in Rome later on, they really then persecuted the saints that didn't go along with it and took control.
Okay, so there's going to be Papal Rome involved here. But before Papal Rome gets involved, now even at the Council of Nicaea, was the Pope in charge of that? Constantine was. Was the Pope there? The Catholic Church says the popes were around. But they weren't there. They didn't have any part in this. I think there were only two bishops from as far away as the West. This is mostly an Eastern area. So papacy really wasn't a part of the issue at this early time. But papacy is going to be. It's going to be. And it's going to be starting about that time, starting to grow. But before papacy, before Constantine, was there persecution of the church? Diocletian.
Yeah, the worst persecution.
That was called the Great Persecution. And there were persecutions even before that, with Nero and Nerva and some of the others that preceded. Finally, the great one was Diocletian. So let's look at that in Revelation chapter 12. And this is pagan Rome. And I think pagan Rome is in Daniel 8:10. I think we're going to see papal Rome in the very next verse. But here in Revelation 12, verse 3 and verse 4. Let's look at those two verses. Ben, why don't you read those for us? Are you there? Yeah. Okay, Revelation 12, 3 and 4.
Revelation 12, 3 and 4.
Yeah. I might interrupt you another way I do.
And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with seven heads and ten horns, and on its heads seven diadems. And his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it.
Okay, so this is a threat to the incipient Christian community that's developing. He's ready to devour this thing, if he possibly could. How many heads does this dragon have on it?
Seven.
Seven heads. How many horns?
Ten.
10 horns. Now, why 7 heads, do you think? How do we rate that Rome had 7 heads? What sense does that make? Pagan Rome, no. Pagan Rome, 7 heads. How can you figure that? Well, remember that Rome conquered all the other kingdoms. Now, let me go back here. I'm going to flip to one of my pictures. Is that okay? There you go. That's good enough. There's a picture of the 4 empires. The 4th one is Rome. Now, there's the lion. How many heads does he have? And there's the bear. How many heads? So that's 2 altogether now. How many here?
4.
4, so we're up to 6. And how many heads? 7. So the Roman Empire kind of was the accumulation and amalgamation of all these things that preceded, and so it's shown pagan Rome with 7 heads that it had absorbed and accumulated. Now, where are the crowns or the diadems? Are they on the horns or are they on the heads on this beast? The heads. Because the 10 horns have not yet got independent authorities yet. The Roman Empire was in charge and they ruled everybody and it was a unified empire and they're persecuting the Christians. That's what's happening. And they're casting down the stars with their great tail and throwing them down to the earth and stamping on them. That's what Daniel said would happen. Revelation says, yeah, that's in the cards here. This is pagan Rome. Now, after this, and the church seemed, boy, you know what John Paul the 23rd said, John 23rd says the church seems fated to die. Well, the real church seemed fated to die here. If it hadn't been that they were whisked up to the throne of God and saved at the last moment, they would have been consumed. But the church has rescued this incipient Christian community. As far as we're going to go in Revelation 12. Now let's go back to Daniel. I just want to lay the groundwork here that Revelation draws upon Daniel 8:10 to make its point, because using the same symbols. By the way, just one other thing. The crowns were on the heads here. But where are the crowns in chapter 13?
On the horns.
On the horns. They're crowned, and that's when papacy is in sympathy with the 10 countries of Europe. By that time, you no longer have a unified Roman Empire. And now papacy is kind of the governor of all these, but they're individually crowned. They have the individual independence. So that tells you the difference. Pagan Rome, 7 heads are crowned. Papacy, during that time, the 10 powers of Europe are independently ruling at that time. So it serves to distinguish the 2 time periods as well. So now back in Daniel, the 8th chapter, now let's look at verse 12. Verse 12. Gloria? This takes the next step from pagan to papal. There's the switch.
Verse 12. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered.
Okay. And now I think you've got papacy that's starting to traduce the saints. Rome just kind of morphed from one to the other. Now, in some scriptures, you can say, well, it was a great battle in heaven. That's Revelation 12. Christianity threw out paganism. But in Revelation 13, it says the dragon gave his seat of authority to the beast, papacy. And that's kind of what's showing here, a transition. It's both Rome, just pagan and papal. That's the same basic thing. Now, I think in Revelation 13, when it says this beast had a wound, but it lived and survived, I think that's the transition from pagan, which was overthrown, to papal, who was healed and then came back as another force. Jeff, you had a thought?
I think that's shown in the other time period of Revelation 12 we don't normally think of. That's the birth of the woman. Now, a birth is usually 40 weeks, the whole pregnancy. So if you multiply that by 7 to get how many days, you get 280. If you date it from 33 when Jesus died and go forward, 280 years later you get to 313. That's when Constantine became a Christian and legalized Christianity in the kingdom. That's when it started, that's the beginning of the shift from the pagan Rome to the papal Rome.
Okay.
They don't get full power until a couple hundred years later.
Okay, so that's when Christianity was kind of born, as it were, as an institution. Okay, that's very nice. It takes you right from 33 to 313, the end of the labor pains, and this child is born. Okay. Now in verse 13, that's going to lead to a time prophecy. It's only one time prophecy in this chapter. And Ben, why don't you keep the reading up with us from here from verse 13.
Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgressions that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?"
Okay. Now this saint, I presume, is an angel. I guess that's what he's seeing. I'm supposing. Okay. I don't know much more about it than that. But then it says, concerning the daily sacrifice. Now, yours said something different. It said the burnt offering. I think that's very good, because that's what the daily sacrifice was. Every day in the tabernacle and in the temple, you had a burnt offering of a lamb in the morning and one again in the afternoon. Now, what does that lamb for a burnt offering every day represent?
Jesus.
Sacrifice. There's the Passover lamb that died on the cross. I think they're related. They're related to each other. Why did you have two lambs every day? Why not just one every day to represent Jesus' sacrifice? Why two?
The six hours that he hung on the cross represent the 6,000 years of sin and death.
That's a good answer to that question.
So the first one would be first age of redemption, or the ransom, and the second would be the restitution.
Okay, so you've got the fact that he was put on the cross in the morning, when they had a morning sacrifice, and he died in the afternoon when they had an evening sacrifice, kind of connects with the two parts. That's good. That's very good. What hour did Jesus was he put on the cross? Third hour. What, put that in my time frame reference.
9 a.m.
9 a.m. Okay, third hour, 9 a.m. What time did he die?
3 p.m.
3 p.m., ninth hour. Okay. Now, I should stick in your frame of reference. Third hour and ninth hour, that's what you said. That's good. Now, later on, third hour and the ninth hour. And then the sixth hour, there was darkness. Okay, that happened. Now, did anything happen later at Pentecost that had to do with the third hour of the day? This is when the benefits of Jesus' atonement first begin to come to us. Anything about the third hour and the day of Pentecost? Yeah, Dave, what do you got?
Oh, some accused the apostles.
Some accused the apostles of being drunk, and so. Was it Peter that stood up and said, "Well, it's not possible. This is only the third hour of the day."
So the Holy Spirit came on the third hour. And without Peter's comment, we wouldn't have known that. So that's very interesting to me. That the same hour that Jesus was put on the cross, that's when, at Pentecost, the Jewish believers received the Holy Spirit. Now, why did Jesus have to be put on the cross? Why couldn't they have taken him out and stoned him? Why did he need to die by crucifixion, Jackie?
Well, what curse is a man hung upon a stake, upon a cross? So he had to take away the curse, and stoning him would not have accomplished that.
There you go. That's it. Who was the curse on? Israel. Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree is under the Jewish law. That's not Adam. That's the Jews. There's the second condemnation. He could have been stoned, but he wouldn't have released the Jews cursed under the law. That's what Paul's saying there. And we can avoid that stake cross question by just using the word tree. It was wood. I got you when you brought that up. That's interesting. But we don't even have to get into that. Just tree. Yeah.
Also, the prophecy states of Jesus' death, that not a bone of his body would make it.
There you go. So stoning would have violated that. Thank you. I forgot about that point, but that's a very good point. Say again?
Can you repeat that for them?
Yes. He brought out the point that if there was stoning, there might have been broken bones, but not a bone of him would be broken. was the prophecy. And the Passover lamb was not to have a bone broken. So that's very good. Bone, you know that Eve was made out of the bone of Adam. She had the same hope, the same prospects, the same benefits as he had. Bone by bone, flesh by flesh. The church has the same goals, prospects as Jesus. And I think that's the picture, the new bride of Jesus, born out of his side, out of his bone. The bones represent your hope for the future. Jesus may have died an ignominious death, but not one prospect for the future was in the least bit damaged or impinged upon. Not a bone of him was broken. Remember what Joseph said? Bring my bones back to, or forward to the promised land. That's my hope for the future. The bones are, the dried bones in Ezekiel 37, that's Israel's hope for the future. Those bones, none of them were broken, all intact. So that's good, no stoning there. So the Jews receive the benefit of the third hour. He's put on the cross for the Jews. He died the ninth hour. Why did he have to die? For all mankind, because Adam died, right? Adam suffered, he's going to redeem Adam. That's the penalty. So this is for all. And all really means Gentiles. Doesn't just uninclude the Jews, but the whole world of mankind. Yes.
And from the Acts study, we also have Acts 10, verse 3,
yeah?
With Cornelius' conversion. About the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God.
A ninth hour? Oh, my goodness. How about that? I love the way these things work. So, everything's timed just the way it should be. I think that third hour is for the Jews and the next one is for the church. Now, for the Gentiles, rather, I should say. Now, if you want to break up everybody in the world into two categories, I suppose you could say, well, that would be all the short people and then all the tall people. Yeah. But that would be a pointless distinction, has no spiritual meaning whatsoever, and all kinds of gray area in between. So, you can divide the world any way you want, but here's the way you do it spiritually. Jews and Gentiles. Now, to prove that point, you find that in Ephesians. You find that Paul does that very thing. Let's look in Ephesians. Let's see where it is. The middle wall of partition, that thing. Let's see. This is chapter 2, I think. Chapter 2, verse 13. Let's start with verse 12. 12 through 15. In fact, 12 through 16. It's a longer passage. Let's see. Carol, do you have that turned there? No, not quite yet. Who's Jackie, go ahead. Oh, you do have it. I'm sorry, Carol, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, Ephesians 2, 12 through 16.
Yes.
Okay. That at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, ye who sometimes were fat off are made high by the blood of Christ. And he is our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments, contained in the ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one, new man, so making peace, and that he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enemy thereby.
Okay. Now, my point here is he divides all of those that come into Christ into categories. Those that had the covenants of promise and those that did not. But now the middle wall is broken down and both are participators. So I think that's spiritually a very vital distinction. Even in Romans 4:16, he talks about the promise made sure to all the seed, not only to that which is of the law, but to those of us, like Abraham, who believed before circumcision. And so that's us Gentiles. Always it's these two classes, the Jews and the Gentiles. Because with them, the Jews were always God's people, and now we got the other side of the coin involved. So I think that's the two different hours. The Jews got it here. The Gentiles got it here. I think that he died for the Gentiles. He had to be put on the cross for the Jews. So I think that's the point. So now going back to Daniel, let's see, how do we get onto this? Oh, yes, yes, the burnt offering in the morning and the evening. That's the whole point. It's a picture of the ransom. That's the whole point. And by the way, if you go through Leviticus and you look for the law of the burnt offering, that's in chapter 1 of Leviticus, and you read the various chapters about the burnt offering and other offerings that come later, it says, when you do a burnt offering in the morning, that's foundational, and everything else goes on top of that. For example, you want to bring a peace offering, which is like a picture of our consecration to God, you put it on the burnt offering, because we're only accepted because Jesus has died for us first. Now, therefore, being reconciled by, justified by faith, we have peace with God, whereby we have access also into this grace in which we stand and rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. We've been justified by the ransom, and now we have the hope of the high calling because of our peace offering of consecration. But it stipulates that goes on top of the burnt offering for the morning and the evening. So we have to have the ransom first, and then our consecration can be accepted. So I think here it's telling us this ransom offering is going to be taken away by some institution. And that, well, what would that be? Randy, what is your thought first?
I just had that thought too, that it would, Paul was the willing servant of the Jewish arrangement and their kings, their line of kings, if he could. But Jesus came along with such power and with an obvious answer to all of the prophetic statements that he immediately saw that there would, that the Romans could be classified as ones who came against Israel. That's one thing. But the larger picture was that there would come a time when they wouldn't even believe what Jesus was had taught Paul. You follow my point? So it becomes that much stronger as it, that A time gap would occur, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah. I just an observation. That's all.
Very good. Thank you. So when it says that the sacrifice, the daily sacrifice, the burnt offering, picturing the ransom, is taken away. What does it say? Was taken away in the place of the sanctuary cast down. Who took away the ransom? Who did that? The little horn. Go ahead.
I was just going to say Papal Rome, when they replaced the efficacy of the ransom with the daily mass.
Yeah, that's it. So that's spiritually how this was fulfilled, I think. Now, in verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking to another say, how long shall be the vision concerning the day of sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, until 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. That's the foundation for William Miller's approach. He says this 2,300 days would end in 1843. That was his opinion. I actually think he was right on that. But then he going on to say, what could be the purging of the sanctuary, but maybe the burning of the earth or something like that. And he missed the whole point. But he did think that this identified the return of Christ. And now we generally say, well, he got the date right, or, you know, about right, but it wasn't the return of Christ. It was just the end of this period. Yes?
It was also the doctrine of the resurrection, too, which came into play, because one of the foundation trigger
discussions had to do with when would the resurrection come? And so each one looking forward to the last day when Jesus would appear, they wondered, they also took, was it First Thessalonians 4, which said that we shall not all sleep, but we shall be changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Well, that was the best way of describing, Paul could describe, that there would be a time period, as I mentioned earlier, then the brethren would know, want to be part of that rapture. Okay. Then it's so beautiful. I'm just observing how it helps my faith, because I could see then that Paul had a grasp, and he would have to almost be quiet at a time and just say, if you are biting on the truth,
you're biting on it, I'm not going to disturb that because I want it to go. It will go into forward until there will be another opposition to the to this great truth.
Yeah.
And we know we're going to come through it, that the truth will be victorious.
Okay, thank you, Brother Randy. Okay, we're going to go farther. We're going to go down to verse 23, because verse 23 is the explanation the angel gives of what he's just seen in the vision. Now, we've been interpreting as we go a little bit, but here's the interpretation that the angel gives. Starting with verse 23, let's have another reader. Who would that? Who would like to volunteer? Yes, Stefan.
When the end of those kingdoms is near and they have become so wicked that they must be punished, there will be a stubborn, vicious, and deceitful king. He will grow strong, but not by his own power. He will cause terrible destruction and be successful in everything he does. He will bring destruction on powerful men and on God's own people.
Okay, now what this is interpreting is this little horn. That's the interpretation that the angel gives to the little horn. He says, in the last days of their kingdom. Whose kingdom? Their multiple. Whose kingdom? The four horns. In the latter days of the four horns, this little horn is going to come up and start to be powerful, and he's going to just practice and destroy the mighty and the holy people. And out of Rome came pagan Rome that destroyed the Jewish people, and then comes that develops into papal Rome, and that persecutes God's people. I think all of that is Rome in its two stages persecuting the Lord's people. Verse 25, through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper, he shall magnify himself, by peace shall destroy many, he shall stand up against the prince of princes. Who's that? Who's the prince of princes? It's got to be Jesus, Prince of Peace. But he will be broken without hand. Now, in Daniel chapter 2, 44, what was broken without hand? The image. And that was clay mixed with iron. That was papal system mixed with the governments of the earth. Broken without hand. So all this is going to be broken without hand. So that connection also makes me think this is papal Rome that's finally going to be broken. And I think we're already beyond the point, actually. But the period of 2,300 days or 2,300 years is the time when the truth would be cast down until the sanctuary began to be cleansed. Now, maybe the sanctuary isn't thoroughly cleansed until the kingdom comes, but this has to be before then. And when the sanctuary is cleansed, then gradually the truth begins to be restored. Now, we have, the dates are all gone here. Oh, yeah, there's the first one would be 1843. Let me erase this and put those things back, some of those dates back. I hate to erase that, but erase this. Let me ask you, where does the 2,300 years begin, and where does it end, and how do we know? Anybody have any comments on that? It doesn't tell us here where the 2,300 years begin. How does anybody have an opinion how to start them? This prophecy is unique because it doesn't tell us. In chapter 9, 70 weeks, it tells us when to begin. And in chapter 12, 12 to 60 days, it tells us when to begin. This one doesn't tell us. How do we possibly know, Jeff?
Don't they connect it usually to the next chapter, which is like a continuation, where you have Daniel chapter 9 that gives you a prophetic starting point for the 490 years? Don't they usually link the two together and say maybe the 2300 starts there?
Okay. The reason here is that in chapter 9, it says, verse 24, why don't you read that if you got it there? Chapter 9, 24.
Daniel 9, 24. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, and to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place.
Okay, now 70 weeks are determined. Sometimes people are either they're cut off or set aside or determined from that previous 2300. That's the theory. Theory is that these 490 are cut off from the 2300. And in the Miller days, it says, I mean, I read the Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers by Frome. He says this was axiomatic among the Miller movement. That's the way they figured it. So when does the 490 start? You read it. It says from the going forth of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, the brethren will differ on this point, but they don't differ very much on the date. But I'll just give you the two differences. This is what Miller believed. Miller believed that that began in Ezra with the decree that Ezra had. And if you look at Ezra chapter 7, you'll see a lengthy decree laid out there in great precision. Half the chapter is taken by this decree to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem. I personally think he's right. I think that's the time. Now, another point of view is that maybe it starts later when Nehemiah went back. It's a very popular view among the brethren. But because of the different datings of all this, it doesn't make much difference more than about 3 years. But be with me as I just explain what Miller did. I'm going to use the date 458, which was the seventh year of Artaxerxes when Ezra got his decree. There's no equivocation that's when he got his decree. It's very clear in Ezra it's the seventh year of Artaxerxes, and we can date that. So using that, tell me when 2300 years would expire. What date should I put over here? Somebody? 1843. Okay, now you had to either know that, or you had to make sure you subtracted in your head and added the 1 year for 0 year and all that. But I think you just knew it. You checked it out. Okay. So that's 1843. That's when it would end. And that's why Miller thought that the Lord would return in 1843. Now, we've already gone through all the prophetic dates. You know that I think that this matches here. It matches the symmetry here. I think it's on the correct level. Some brethren use 1846, 3 years different, not much different. It's basically the same concept, and that is when the Miller movement came to its fruition, then all of the old errors had pretty much been identified. The Trinity was seen to be wrong. The immortality of the soul was seen to be wrong. All these new strands of thought, a hope for the world, were put in place, and it didn't all come together until Second Advent. But the cleansing was there. And Volume 3 talks about this. I pretty much follow the presentation of Volume 3. My date is just 3 years different for the reason I stated. But I think that this is on track. Now, when you go back to the prophecy itself, in Daniel chapter 8, how many empires are discussed in Daniel chapter 8, not four, how many, well, I don't mean the four horns, but I mean the basic empires. How many are referred to in Daniel chapter 8? You got, yes?
Three.
You got three. You got Persia, you got the Grecian goat, and you've got the Roman beast that's going to come a little later. I'm going to open this up for a little bit of, just a little bit of fresh air here, so I don't fall asleep on you. So when we start this, one thought is, well then, you can have one of these visions starting in the time of the Persian Empire. It starts in the reign of Artaxerxes. Everybody will agree it starts in the reign of Artaxerxes. I don't know of another opinion, you know, among the Bible students on this point. So that's sometime during the Persian Empire. Now, when you open the vision, it just says, I saw a ram. That's it. There was a ram there. So it's sometime during the Persian Empire. Now, if you look for another starting point, you know, to think about what the options are, then you see something with respect to the Grecian Empire. And the first thing you see in the prophecy is that that goat, is going to run headlong against that ram. Now, when did that occur? When did those two come into conflict for the first time? Does anybody happen to know when Alexander went against the Grecian Empire at the first? I'll tell you. Oh, that's the date I think it was. Yeah, that's the date. That works.
It did.
Okay. So that's 334 BC. Now, this is of interest to me. The fact that the prophecy does not tell you when to start opens the option that there might be various starting points available. That's the one that we usually use, bringing you the 1840s. That's good. I think that's the primary one. Yeah, it's wonderful. But Paul, you asked about spiritual Israel as a church or natural Israel maybe? Well, guess what? Let's take 2300 days from 334 BC and see where natural Israel, when is the sanctuary, or at least the Temple Mount, cleansed, as it were, back in Jewish hands. Let's see how many years, 2300 years from 334. What does that bring you? 1967. Well, that is interesting, because that was the year they got the Temple Mount back. And I can't help but think that on the level of natural Israel, there's an applicability to this, and that's why the ambiguity about where to start it. Now, I have no problem with the start that we've got, but I think it's ambiguous to allow the other possibilities. Now, there's a third possibility, and this I got from Brother Jim Parkinson. And I think he's right. And that is, when did the Roman... you've got one dating from the sometime during the Persian Empire, one dating when the goat came west against the Persian Empire. And now with Rome, that's the third empire, is when Rome began to... Oh, got to go to the other one. When Rome began to develop as an independent, as a power that would rise and subsume other powers. When do you start the history of the Roman Empire? Now, that's kind of a hard question to answer. Jeff, do you have a thought?
Just repeating from one of your talks.
Okay. Well,
the sack of the Gauls is what you...
Sometimes I need somebody in the audience on that level. But remember, this wasn't an original opinion with me, but I was attracted to it. See, I'm normally attracted to things that I think of. You know, I like this from Brother Jim. But actually, there's a historian that if you want to read the development of Rome, you read this historian. Now, what was his name? Polybius, that was the name. Thank you. Polybius is the author of the History of the Roman Empire, you know, a very good old Greek writer. And he says, well, the same question, where shall I start this? Yes? Kind of. But he says, what activity should we start with the history of the Rome towards this expansion? He says, well, for the purposes of our history, I think the good starting point would be when the Gauls sacked Rome and gave it back to the Romans by treaty, and from that point forward, you can mark the rise of the Roman power. They got their city back. They built a wall around it. They went out and started conquering other tribes. They took care of Italy. They got to Sicily. They started expanding the Mediterranean, and they became an empire. So he dates it from the year that the Gauls sacked Rome, and that is a turning point in history. Yes, Jeff?
When they built that wall around it, that's when they had the Seven Hills.
That's right. It became the Seven Hills city enclosed by those walls. Okay. So what year was that? What year was the...
387?
387. Sorry. 387 BC. Okay, let's just try that, and let's see if it leads to any productive results. But before we do, before I ask for the answer, let me remind you of this verse. Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, the last part of the verse. He shall stand up against the prince of princes, but he will be broken, how? Without hand. That reminds me of the date 1914, you know, a little bit. Okay, well, let's see. Now, if you go 2300 years from 387 BC, what year do you get to? It really works. Okay.
If you stretch the math.
Explain yourself. What do you mean? Math is not flexible. It's inflexible. It's always right. Okay. So that takes you to 1914. So somebody asked me, when do the 2300 days begin and end? I will say, well, this is where I think the spiritual picture is for us and the church. But I think for natural Israel, really they got the Temple Mount back in 1967. I don't see them giving it up again. And in 1914, that's when the Roman influence came under judgment with the Roman papal institution, you know, in Christendom. So I think all three of those have some merit. I actually embrace all three of these at the same time. Yes?
Can you put Greece and Rome by the other two?
I should, thank you. Because that really makes the point that there's one beginning in each empire. And there's not four empires here. There's only three. Persia, Greece, and Rome. And I could add to that, by the way, who was the biggest persecutor of the Jewish nation before they were broken by Rome? Antiochus Epiphanes. Which kingdom did he belong to? Greece. So that's the persecution that belongs to natural Israel. So maybe the time frame for natural Israel, you know, sticks with that, with that empire. Yes, David.
In 1967, they got Jerusalem back. So you're saying that, you know, did they really get the Temple Mount back then? You could make a case that the Temple Mount is
the old city.
Yeah, I mean, territorially they have Jerusalem back, but what do you say about the Arabs having the Temple Mount? In fact,
okay, you make it. That's a very good question, but you said.
It's the old city,
but it includes the Temple Mount. It's Israeli jurisdiction. But you bring a very good point. Who was the hero of that war? I had a patch over one eye.
Dayan.
Moshe Dayan. The way I hear it, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that he's the one that kind of gave the authority of the Temple Mount over to the Muslim leader, the Waqf, or Waqf, as you call it, W-A-Q-F. I don't know how you pronounce it. And from that day forward, it's been under the control of, kind of the control of the Islamics. But it's really politically still under the jurisdiction of Israel. When they decide to close it down, they close it down. When they decide you can't come, you know, young Islamics can't come for prayers that day, that's Israel decides that. They're in charge. So I really think that with the day they got it back and the day they gave up the authority over its jurisdiction, you know, on a daily basis, that was a black mark for Israel. Really black mark. Now, what happened a few years after that? 1973, the Yom Kippur War? They barely got out of that thing. I mean, some of the reports I hear later is that it was, their collapse was precarious before God rescued them. And who was the prime minister at that time? Golda Meir. And you know what she did in the aftermath? She resigned. That's when you had people of some nobility of character that said, you know, I messed up. She waited until she got things in order. She didn't leave them, you know, out of in a lurch. But as time went by, she resigned. And that's a noteworthy thing in my mind. She takes a big notch in character up in my mind. I mean, she was in many ways she was a very rough and tumble person, but that nobility strikes me. What did you say, Randy?
Oh, she got phantom jets too. She waited until America gave her. Phantom jets with which she could win the war.
In 73?
Or at least bring it a stalemate. That was what she waited for.
I see.
And it was a very, very dicey situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she did manage to get it. Yeah. What is your observation again about Moshe Dayan? Why did he decide to take it? Why did he decide to take that?
You know, I think he was just trying to be politically sensitive and pleasant and agreeable and all that. But, you know, you don't give away things God gave you. And that's you don't make a compromise with the people of the land. Israel's trying to do that. And in the aftermath of all this, I think people will look back in the kingdom and say, you know, they tried everything. They gave back land. They gave the temple. They tried this. They tried that. Nothing would work. And so I think they'll end up being justified in the big picture. But really, they're undergoing problem after problem after problem as a consequence of their effort to compromise on these points. Now, compromise is not a bad word. We all compromise. If a person that doesn't compromise is all by himself.
But you also know that it's interesting to note, too, that the Heavenly Father is not going to make it easy for them to have that because they have been in the past so negligent, so uncaring about the land when they were given promise after. And here, the Heavenly Father seems to say he's going to make them every
victory will be hard won, and you will actually make mistakes, and then I'll fight for you again, and then you, this type of thing. It's really a seesaw battle.
So I think in this eighth chapter, we've got three levels of meaning here. Now, somebody might want to take that little horn and do something else with it, like Islam or something else. I'm not against that option. If it's there, I think it's a subsidiary option, just like there's three options for the dating here. But I really think that that horn is Rome. That's primarily it. Okay, anything else on the eighth chapter you want to look at or talk about or think about? Yes, Jeff.
Talk about more why you pick 458 as the decree.
Okay. Now that gets into the ninth chapter. It's the very next chapter. It's the 70-week prophecy. That's right. That's right. We got a few minutes. Maybe we should get into that a little bit. Let's look at the very text that talks about this. Daniel 9:24. Jeff, can you read that for us? Daniel 9:24.
Which Jeff?
I'm sorry, the one I'm talking to at the time.
Daniel 9:24.
Yes.
70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place.
Now, was that, which verse did you read?
9:24.
That was 24.
That's New American Standard.
Oh, let me look at my Bible here.
Do you want a King James?
I got a King James here. Let's see.
Are you talking about 25, 26, and 27?
Yeah, 25. I'm sorry, 25. What you read is excellent. That's
I'm
going
to go back to King James.
Okay. Well, if 25 is what I want, I didn't ask for it. But go ahead.
Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times.
Okay. Now the question is, when is the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? And I can tell you, essentially, that it depends upon how you date ancient history. And in Volume 2, there's a statement that says, it's a page 64, 66, something like that, based on the works of these two people, Joseph Priestley and the others, Hales, William Hales, they show that the common view of history is 9 years different. And therefore, we have to readjust history. And if you do that, the only way you're going to get that prophecy to work is to start it in the days of Nehemiah, whereas William Miller started that in the days of Ezra. How many years were there apart between Ezra and Nehemiah? Does anybody happen to know? They both went back in the year in the same king. Okay. No, a little more than four. One went back in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. That's undisputed, by the way. And the other went back later in Artaxerxes. In what year did Nehemiah go back? 20th year? Yeah, that's it. So how many years apart are they? 13 years apart. So this is the presentation in Volume 2. Now, Brother William Miller and Brother Russell did it just a little bit differently. But in Volume 2, he says, well, let's see, if the normal date for the 20th year is 445, but we're going to change history by 9 years, add 9 years onto that, and what do you get? Just add 9 years to that. You really get 454. That's it. If you just add, no zero year calculation here. Okay. Now, somebody tell me, if I start with the year 454, and I go forward 490 years, what date do I come to? And you do have to deal with the zero-year problem here. Well, let's see. That'd be 6 plus 1, 37 A.D. That's right. That's what you get to if you don't deal with the zero-year problem. Now, does that make sense? What happened in 37 A.D.? It doesn't.
Nothing.
Nothing happened in 37. I mean, something happened, but nothing of import that the 70th week should take you to. So if you use the other option of 458... That is the historical year for the seventh year of Artaxerxes. Well, let's try that out. Let's go to 458. And let's add 490 and do the zero-year adjustment, all that. What year do you come to? 33. That's the year that something did happen. Jesus died on the cross, brought an everlasting atonement for sin, and all of that. It's so easy, it's so simple, I think it makes sense. And I think that is the answer. I think that's the 70 weeks. Now, if you want to insist it's the other way, it's okay. But you know why? You know why people are attracted to the view that maybe it's supposed to take you after the death of Christ? You know, like to 36 with a Cornelius or something like that? There's one concept, and that is, when did Jesus die relative to the 70th week? When? That's what I was looking for you to say. Because it says he'll be cut off in the midst of the week, right? Show me the scripture. Show me the scripture that says he'll be cut off in the midst of the week. I mean, it's got to be there. We've all got it in our brain.
27. 9:27?
Okay, I want it to say he's cut off in the midst of the week. Read that for me.
It doesn't say he's cut off in the midst of the week. It says, and in the midst of the week. He
what? He'll
cause the sacrifice and the oblation to see.
That's verse 27. Yeah. That's what happens in the middle of the week. What verse says he's cut off?
Verse 26.
Well, this isn't in the same verse then.
No.
He'll be cut off, but not for himself. In the midst of the week, he'll cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. That's my point. In my brain, I have this expression, he'll be cut off in the midst of the week. That is not in Scripture. There are two separate texts. The cutting off is there. The midst of the week is there. They're not cut off in the midst of the week. It's so much in the minds of all Christians, and mine as well, you think that's the way it reads, but it doesn't. Gabriella. Daniel 9, 26, and, what did you say?
27.
27 and 26. Okay. The first one says he'll be cut off, but not for himself. He's cut off for all of us. The second one says, in the midst of the week, he'll cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. Cheryl.
If I could read them, it actually says, so you were to know and discern that from the, 26. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And his end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a full, firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. That goes on from there. So the cutting off actually comes after the 62 weeks.
Okay. Now, this is a very unusual prophecy. It mentions, puts it in pieces. He says, well, there'll be seven of those Sabbaths, and then 62 more. So that makes a total of 69. And sometime after the 69th week, he's going to end up dying.
Can you draw that on the board?
Let's see. Somewhere. Okay. You mean the 7 and the 62? You want all that? There's the 7. There's the 62. 7 weeks would be 49. 62 times 7. What's that? 434? Now add 434 and 49. That's 483. So that's a total of 483. And now, the last week of 7 years, and that total makes 490. There's your total. And so that's the last week of 7 years. So here's the question. When did Jesus die? Well, relative to the 70th week, yes.
But wouldn't it be 49 plus the remaining 451 to get to the end of the 490 and then go back 7 instead of going forward 7? Or am I missing something?
Well, this is 62 weeks here. That's 7 weeks there. 62, excuse me.
Sorry.
How many total is that? 69?
No,
you're good enough for this. It's just a matter of all of us have to, these numbers are spinning around. That's one more week. That's a total of 70 weeks. Okay, now let's look and see really what the prophecy says about when Christ would appear. Let's see what it says. Daniel, the 9th chapter. Let's read verse 25 again. I might interrupt somebody here. Reads, Jeff, did you have that? Or Sherelle, you've got it. Or you got it, okay.
Daniel 9:25.
Yes.
Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks.
Okay. From the commandment to Messiah is going to be 69 weeks. So, what that's telling us is that if Jesus died after 69 weeks, you know, he can't die immediately at the end of that, because he doesn't appear until the end of that. He's got 3.5 years to go. So sometimes men say, well, does he appear here then, at right after the 62? And my answer is no. My answer is what the prophecy means is that if you want to wait for Messiah, you've got to finish 69 weeks. Now, what if the prophecy had said, you've got to finish 70 weeks? It would have overshot it. Because I think that Jesus presented himself at Jordan here, that's 29, and then he died here in 33 at the end. So in number of weeks, not days, but weeks, that's what the prophecy is. How many weeks do you wait until Messiah is going to come? You wait 69 of them, and then Messiah comes after that. But if you said, well, wait 70, you would have missed it. He would have already been dead by that time. That's why it says he will come after 69 weeks, but everlasting righteousness will be accomplished in 70 weeks, 33 AD when he died. Now remember, if you start with 454, you're not going to get to the answer you might want. So that view cannot mathematically maintain. It's that old zero-year pesky problem, but you know what makes a difference here? It makes a big difference. Beyond that, if you look back historically, you find that those old sources, they were sources written 200 years ago at a time when the history of this time was still pliable. Today, it is not. Unless you simply wish to ignore the evidence. And there are people that want to ignore the evidence. But it is not pliable today. You have all the facts on the table. Jackie?
I just want to make sure I understand something. If Jesus was cut off in the middle of the week, the 70th one, it would be 33. But wouldn't the 70th week actually end in 36?
If he was cut off in the midst of the week, then you are correct. That's why it's of note to me to notice that the prophecy does not actually say he's cut off in the midst of the week. That's in my brain. But it's taking a part of one verse, splicing it together with a part of the other verse, and making one expression out of it. It actually isn't in the scripture. And you know, imagine my surprise when I came to realize, you know, this whole subject, and I thought, well, what do you do with that scripture? So I looked it up, and I kept looking it up. It's not there. The scripture isn't there. Now, let's look at what Paul says. Oh, sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
Well, if you download the Priestley and Hill's books on chronology off the internet, as far as I recall, they don't even say that.
Yeah, they do.
What they're saying, they're giving some different thoughts, and then in the next chapter when you get there, they say, well, we think the thought from the previous chapter is incorrect,
yeah,
and this is why we think it's incorrect.
Yeah. Hales actually doesn't even refer to such a view. He doesn't know of such a view. He never deals with such a view. Hales is simply being misunderstood. Hales actually thought this way within a year. And so Hales is just, it's a miscitation. It's just, I think I know where the mistake is. I think if you add up a few years, it comes out to 9, and it has nothing to do with this period of history. It's simply a mistake. Priestley talks about the 9-year view and then explains he has a different view that he agrees with. And it's different than my view too. But the point is, today, all of those 200-year-old works are really no longer relevant. Jeff?
This is just a little bit different side of the question, but one of the things that's helped me, because I kind of struggled with those verses too, kind of one way of looking at it, and I thought, well, if I'm going to look at it differently, what do I do with this? And one of the things that's helped me is to break down how those verses of Daniel are structured. You start out with, here's what the 70 weeks will accomplish, and the next verse is the 60 and the 7. So, okay, so now we're starting to break it down. Here's the 69 weeks leading to the last week. And then verses 27, 26 and 27 are covering the whole 7th week. It's not saying, well, here's what happens at the start, and then here's what happens in the middle. And then it's just saying, It's sort of like how in the beginning you discussed what the whole 490 years are going to accomplish. Now you're discussing what the seventh week or the last week of that 490 years is going to accomplish. And it's just like a listing. In fact, it even goes forward in time in the 26th verse to Titus and the Roman invasion of Judea and so on. So it's not specific. It's just here's the seventh week, and all these things are going to happen in the seventh week.
Yeah.
The only time it gets specific is when it says that in the middle of the week, the sacrifice and the oblation will cease. So you have to decide what that means.
Okay.
But the rest of it is just a listing of things. So.
Okay, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Jeff, you had a comment first.
Just a quick aside, another one. The Priestley family and Henry Grew family knew each other. They were both in Birmingham, England.
Mm-hmm.
Priestley was a non-Trinitarian.
Yeah.
And the Birmingham riots were, they were trying to burn down the city to get at Priestley and his family. So they fled to America with the Grew family and others over on a boat in about 1801 or so. And Henry Grew, of course, was the one who gave George Storrs the idea there was no hellfire, no mortal soul, and George Storrs was the direct connecting link to Brother Russell.
So there's a connection between Priestley and the Truth Movement in that respect. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Now, Henry Grew was an American, right?
He was born in America, but his family was from England, from Birmingham, England.
Henry Grew's family.
Yeah. They came over in the same boat.
But Joseph Priestley didn't come to America.
His family, he did for a little bit, and he went back.
Okay. All of that is interesting to me. I didn't know.
Henry Grew lived in England for a while, though, right? So.
No, there was two Henry Grews.
Oh, all right.
Okay. Well, let me get back to this question about in the midst of the week, what happens? That's where we are in Daniel. Now, turn with me if you would. Remember, in the midst of the week, he'll cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. What does he mean, the sacrifice and oblation? Of what? What sacrifice? What oblation?
The sacrifice and the obligations of the law.
There we go. Keep that in mind. That's what we want to deal with. When was that removed? Now let's look at Hebrews 10, verse 7 through 9. Hebrews 10, 7 through 9. This is Paul's comment about when the offerings of the law faded away. And let's see, who can read that for us? Gracia, would you? 7 through 9.
Hebrews 10, verse 7. Then I said, behold, I have come in the role of a book that is written to do thy will, O God. After saying above, sacrifices and offerings.
After saying above, gotta find my place again. Okay. I'll start over.
Okay.
Then I said, behold, I have come in the roll of the book. It is written of me to do thy will, O God. After saying above, sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, thou hast not desired, nor hast thou taken pleasure in them which are offered according to the law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do thy will. He takes away the first in order to establish the second.
Now, when did Jesus say, lo, I come to thy will, O God?
Jordan,
29 A.D. That's where Paul says he takes away the first that he may establish the second. What's the first? The type. What's the second? The fulfillment. The antitype. At Jordan, he became the bullock for the sin offering. He was burned for 3.5 years of suffering and sacrifice. So I think at Jordan is where all this began. Now, what year was Jordan? 29. Now, let's just check something out here. At Jordan is when he really replaced the law with the antitype of it. Now, let's get that period of probation that we talked about earlier for 40 years. Let's count 40 years from there. What year do we get to? 69. 69 was the last time the Jews could observe the Day of Atonement offerings in the temple. By the next spring, the temple was destroyed. They had 40 years to accept our Lord as the antitype of this offering. Those that didn't suffered. Those that did got the heavenly prize. So I think that 40 years is telling us something also about the removal of the old law. But Paul says that's where he puts away the first and he establishes the second. I think that's in the midst of the week, the sacrifice and oblation ceased. Now, I admit that if the prophecy pointed to his death instead, I would say, okay, that's when the law was nailed to the cross. You know, prophecy is flexible. I can't insist it has to be this way. What I say is, this is the only way the numbers will work. What did I say earlier? Math is not flexible. It's inflexible. This is the only way. And therefore, I have no problem with understanding the prophecy this way. Gloria?
Well, actually, that was my question.
Okay.
What, you know, what did he mean by that he nailed the law to his cross? You know, although it does say, you know, that all these things are going to occur, is Paul actually giving us a timeline here, or is he just giving us a summation of the work of Messiah where, when he says he nailed it to his cross, he's giving us a specific time point?
That's a very good question, very good point. You know, that's why I say I wouldn't judge the issue on this point. I wouldn't, you know, insist on this too strongly. But if the numbers are what's the inflexible part. And so with the numbers, I say, well, you know, I have no problem reading this as to fulfillment. Yeah, I always start with the strongest point and then make the others fit, you know. And I think you're right. Sherelle.
One of the problems I've had with the Nehemiah interpretation is that it starts in Nisan. And for it to be a 3.5-year prophecy, the starting date is important. So if you're going to do 3.5 years, you've got them being crucified in the fall instead of the spring.
Okay, that six-month imprecision is a very interesting point. Very interesting point. Now, one of the things that comes into this discussion, did we look at Ezra? Ezra, the 7th chapter. I want to go there. And I want to show you the decree. Say again. Oh, sorry, Randy. Go ahead.
Related to that is that under, if you want to call it the old way, it mentions that Jesus was presented himself in 29, died in 3.5 years later, but also Cornelius, the Gentile first Gentile convert, would be at the end of the 70th week. Is the general feeling. Is that not correct?
If Jesus died in the midst of the week,
right,
then you got to find some termination for the end. And that terminated, the only logical thing could be the conversion of Cornelius.
Right. But the period, the whole period would be a period of favor. We're describing the 70 weeks are a period of favor.
Yeah. Okay, that's very good. There's a problem, though, with dating Cornelius. How do you date the conversion of Cornelius? There's no way. There's no way. 490
years.
490 years. The point is, you can't establish that date for Cornelius. But surprisingly, you can say something about the date of Cornelius. You know what year it was not? It was not 36. Now, it seems like a bold claim. Can you really show it was not 36? Dave, was your comment on this point?
Yeah.
Well, you comment.
In Galatians, Paul writes, Paul writes that he spent 3 years in his city. What city was that?
Damascus?
Damascus. Yeah. He spent 3 years in Damascus and before he went to Jerusalem. And so before he went to Jerusalem, you know, there's a number of events that happen in the book of Acts that simply would add up to more than 3.5 years. If you take that 3 years that he spent in Damascus before he went to Jerusalem.
Okay, let me get this straight now. You're saying that in Acts he spent 3 years at Damascus.
Galatians.
I'm sorry, the book of Galatians. Okay. So let me ask you, when was Paul converted? In what year? Yes.
That's what I was going to kind of go see if we could go through that, because that's probably 34 A.D.
34 A.D.
Maybe you can prove that. Maybe you can kind of show us how you do that.
Okay.
That's, you know, Frank had that idea.
Frank did too, 34.
So he, you know, that's not like a new thought.
Okay, just for a moment, rather than going into all the details to show 34, let's just for the moment assume that's what it is. Now maybe you say, well, it's 35, 36, but it was no earlier than 34, I don't think. After all, Stephen had to be, you know, elevated to a deacon. He had to be prosperous. He had to go out and, you know, convert a lot of people, and then he had to be stoned. And then after that, Paul had to be converted. So let's say 34 at the earliest. And I think we can show it was 34, but let me bypass that for now. That means that if he is 3 years at Damascus, he's at 37, is that correct? 37 A.D. when he comes to Jerusalem? That makes sense. Now, what chapter in Acts does he come to Jerusalem? In the record of Acts. When does he go visit Jerusalem and spend 15 days with Peter and, you know, go in and out with the apostles? Well, what chapter in Acts does Paul visit Jerusalem after his conversion? Nope, before that. Well, it's chapter 9, I believe. And so Paul 9 is where Paul, see, in chapter 9, Saul was yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples. And then he's converted. And then he goes to Damascus. And then you say, according to Galatians, he was there for 3 years.
Yeah, verse 118.
Oh, that's in Galatians, you mean?
Correct.
Yeah, that's fine. And so then he was so prolific in his testimony in Damascus, the Jews were ready to kill him. How did he escape the city? They set a band out to the gate, you know. How did he get out of there, Jackie?
In a basket.
In a basket. His friends let him down.
Through a window in the wall of the city.
Yeah.
And God didn't have to go through the gate. He got out. Now, who was the king at that time? King of Damascus. There's a name. Maybe it's in the book of later in Corinthians or somebody. I don't know. But his name is Aretas. That was the king of Damascus. And you follow the history of that time, he couldn't have been king of Damascus before 37 A.D., something like that. I think that's the reason. So that's why Paul couldn't have left Damascus before 37.
That's 2 Corinthians 11:32.
2 Corinthians
11:32.
So if he left Damascus in 37, no earlier than that, well, you back up 3 years, he's converted in 34. But maybe you say, well, it could have been later than that. That's fine, but it's deepening the problem. If he left Damascus in 37 or 38 or 39, then it says he came to Jerusalem. And then before the ninth chapter ends, in the ninth chapter, verse 28 of Acts, he was with them coming in and going out at Jerusalem. He spoke boldly in the name of the Lord Jesus. He disputed against the Grecians, and they went out about to slay him, and he had to leave. And when he finally left and went back to his home city of Tarsus, it says, then had the churches peace in Judea, because he wasn't there to stir up this opposition. And that's the end of the ninth chapter, you know, even before the end of the ninth chapter. When does Cornelius come into the picture? Chapter 10. After Peter's done some things on his own, after Paul's out of the picture, then Cornelius comes in while Peter's at Joppa. So the point of this is, this flow shows that Cornelius did not come into the picture until 37 or later. We don't know which year it was. We know it was not 36 or 34 or 33. It couldn't be earlier than 37. Jeff?
Now, how did you prove 34 again?
Well, Aretas could not have been king before 37. How do I prove that? I've got to do a little digging into the history of who Aretas is, when he had a conflict with Rome, and this and that and the other thing. But if you look up Aretas, I think you'll probably find this pretty accurate. So Paul couldn't escape from Damascus before then. 3 years earlier, he would have been converted in 34. If it was 38 or 39, he would have been converted later. But you have problems with that down the road when he stands before Gallio, the deputy of Corinth or wherever it was. And so you have problems with that. But for our purposes, it's very simple. For our purposes, Paul did not escape Damascus until Aretas was king. 37. And Cornelius was converted after that. Very simple. It wasn't year 36. Randy?
Just what we'd like to harmonize to is that Jesus said, go ye first unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And that would indicate that after 37, would certainly be the time that Cornelius would come in my view.
Yeah.
So that's how I still harmonize it.
But. Yeah, and I think there was this temporary period where, you know, the Jews had the chance first. I think that all that's correct. Now let's look, just by the way, as a verification of this. Bill, you tell me when I'm supposed to stop. I think maybe through it.
I got one.
Okay.
I think Shane has got the food now,
okay.
So.
Okay. Let me show you something about the parallels that I think support this thing very, very, very well. If the 70th week was from 26, the middle of the week was 29, and the end of the week was 33 when he died. That's what we're suggesting. Let's suppose that's right. Let's go 40 years into the future. That would be 66, 69, 73. Now, what happened in 66? That's when the Roman wars with Judea started. That's when the Jews rebelled. It's unambiguous. It was the year 66. And in 69 was the last year of peace they had. They could observe their Day of Atonement offerings in the temple. The next spring it was destroyed. And by 73, Masada fell, and that's the end of the 7 years Roman War. So there's something significant about 40 years apart. Now let's try this. Let's say the end of this is 36. 40 years later would be 76. Any meaning to 76? No, there's nothing. It doesn't fit. So let's go on a little further. Let's go 1845 years down the stream of history. 1871, 1874, and 1878. Now, did anything happen in 74? Well, Jesus came. 78, Israel was restored. 71, that's not as familiar. But guess what? 40 years later, what happened? World War I. Let me ask you, what nation was primarily the instigator of World War I? Germany. I mean, it's just a matter of fact, you know. I mean, I've got German in me, but it's a fact anyway, you know. It's just, that's what happened. So this is 1918, and this is 1911. World War I began here, it ended here. Those dates are credible, right? Now let's extend this out to 1881. I know that's a popular date. And this would be 1921? What, anything happened in 1921? Nothing.
They got out of the war with the First World War. That's when they signed the peace treaty with Germany.
Is that right? Okay. Well, then maybe there's something. But okay. So, but you know, in 1881, the parallel here, it's something we can't see. That's the problem. It's something you can't see. And, you know, it's, we kind of backed into that one. And if, of all the disputed parallel dates, that's the one I can look at with most, you know, uncertainty. So I think that really, 76, nothing happened. I don't think anything happened in 36. Nothing happened of, I'll look at that again. That's a valid answer. It's a valid possibility. But in all the other dates, something did happen. You know, I have a four-volume set by Winston Churchill on World War I. You know what the title of the four-volume set is? World Crisis, 1911 to 1918. That's when he marks the beginning of the crisis. And you go back to 1871. Germany is what started all this. That's where Germany was founded as an empire, as a country, as a state that later caused World War, 1871. So that's the predicate for all this. What happened in 26? That's when Pontius Pilate was appointed governor of Judea, kind of the predicate for everything that unfolded thereafter. I think these do have meaning. I think the parallels are intact. But I think if you use 36, you have trouble down the road. It just doesn't work. Jeff?
1871 is also the date of the Papal Infallibility Decree.
Interesting. Okay, that is interesting. Okay, so that's the 70 weeks, that's the ninth chapter. Not much different, you know, we all know when Jesus died, 33. That's the real point. But I'll show you one more thing about the 70 weeks that I think follows as a natural consequence. If you use the ending of the, you know, the starting of the kingdom, when I think it's going to be, if you do that, then you have a total. Now, I had this on the board yesterday. I think I'm going to have to erase a little more to draw this. And I'm going to erase this. Now, the seventh creative day is how long? The seventh creative day. Not asking about each one, just the last seventh creative day. How long is that? Anybody want to venture a thought? 7,000 years, that's what we usually say. I think that's correct. All the creative days had how many parts? Somebody who was here yesterday knows that. An evening and a morning, okay. So if you take the 7,000 years of human history, you can divide it into two parts. Each one of those is 3,500 years. Now, according to the view that I think is right, do you know what the middle date of 7,000 years is? Do you know what that... I know some of you know. Say again?
458.
Exactly right. I even remember when I found that out. I was using a calculator that was the predecessor of this one. And it was late at night. Late at night, and I, you know, was just working with it. I said, well, when would the middle point be? And I did a little figure, and I said, I could hardly believe it. Because I knew what that number was. 458 BC. I knew already that that was the beginning of the 70-week prophecy of Daniel. That from there you start counting at that point. 490 years to the death of Christ. And then after that, the first age of redemption, and then the second age of redemption, everything begins right there. Right in the morning of this period, where it's evening and now morning, it's marked. I mean, if you came from my point of view, thinking what I thought and seeing that, well, you can understand. Well, that's why I'm excited. Now, as I tell people, what I am one thing but not the other. What am I? I said it during the intermission. I'm persuaded, but I'm not dogmatic. I am persuaded. There is no doubt. I am persuaded. But I'm not dogmatic. You know what the difference is? It's not level of intensity. The persuaded person says, I believe it. The dogmatic person says, you got to believe it. I'm not there. Okay. But I am persuaded. And so, you know, I'm tentative. I don't want to, you know, disturb the brethren. I don't like to create difficulty. But I am persuaded. And if this is right, how can you keep your mouth shut? How can you do that? That would just be, I think, wrong. But you have to be discreet and pleasant and, you know, and not try to create difficulty. But I know that some brethren feel quite strongly that I'm on a wrong course. I appreciate their integrity. We just differ on that point. But when I see things like this, I say, this is on the right path. You know, that's pattern, that's harmony, that's symmetry, that speaks of order. That's, what is the word today? Intelligent design. That tells us we're on the right track. And I think I should stop there. Is it time to stop?
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
It's almost time, so.